Welcome to Half Stack Data Science, the show about data science in the real world. Some housekeeping to start with. A reminder that my book Solve Any Data Analysis Problem is out later this year. You can already buy it and read it in its draft form as part of Manning's Early Access Program. If you want to practice your data skills on real-world problems and learn a reusable framework to use on any project in the future, this book is for you. We'll link to details in the show notes. Now on to today's episode. We're continuing our series of conversations about data education, and in this episode we spoke to Richie Cotton. Richie is a data evangelist at DataCamp. He started his career as a data scientist, working in industries from chemical health and safety to debt collection to proteomics. After joining DataCamp in 2016, he switched to teaching data and AI skills. He has created 10 courses on data science that have been taken by over 700,000 learners and worked with instructors to create over 50 courses that have been taken by millions of learners. Richie has also written two books on R programming, Learning R and Testing R Code. In his current role, Richie hosts the Data Framed podcast and runs the DataCamp webinar program, as well as creating tutorials and cheat sheets for data and AI skills. We spoke to Richie about how DataCamp's offering and focus has changed over time to meet market demands, with some inevitable comments about Python versus R, what the impact of generative AI has been on data education, and what the future holds. So please enjoy our conversation with Richie Cotton. All right, we're here with Richie Cotton. Richie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm excited to chat with you.
Yeah, great. So we'll just start with the question we ask everyone, which is, what is your job title and what do you really do all day?
Oh man, great question. So my job title is data evangelist, and the short answer is I just chat about data and AI all day. So I'm one of the hosts of the Data Framed podcast. So it's nice to be answering questions for a change rather than asking them. And I also run DataCamp's webinar program. So we have a lot of experts come on and teach people all about how to use data and AI.
So how did you get to that? Like, how does someone become a data evangelist? What's the typical path if they're
obviously you go to data evangelist school. Sorry, convent or monastery.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's obviously no degree for becoming a data evangelist. My background was that I was originally a data scientist. So I worked in a few different industries. I worked in chemical health and safety doing data science. And then I switched and I moved to debt collection, which is a bit of a change, very weird industry. And then I moved to doing data science in a proteomics team and asked stupid questions about biology. And then I ended up at DataCamp. So DataCamp makes online courses for data and AI skills. And so I got into teaching people skills. So I was creating courses for a while. I've shifted around a bit. And I somehow ended up as the evangelist. Actually, what happened there was the job application was, the description was open for months and months at a time, and no one was applying. Apparently, it's not a thing people want to do, or at least there are no suitable people for this. And eventually my boss said, you know, Richard, you can hold conversations. Why don't you apply for this job? And I did, and it turned out to be a great fit.
Yeah, I mean, no one types that into a job search, do they? Which is interesting, because it is a job that must suit quite a lot of people out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd in that you need a mix of technical skills in order to be able to hold an intelligent conversation about data, but you also need to understand a bit about, like, what are the use cases of this and what do people care about? So you need some sort of teaching skills and also just being able to yabber away a bit.
What kind of courses did you create when you first joined DataCamp?
So my background was in the R community. So most of my courses are on R programming. So
yeah, take that, Python guests on the previous episodes.
We have got a bit of a Python bias on the podcast.
Two versus one today, David.
Yeah, so annoyingly, I did do one Python course, and that is my most popular course by far.
What is it? Python for R dummies? Is that the?
So that course is on. It's getting started using pandas. It's about data manipulation skills. Yeah. So it's pretty fundamental, and so yeah.
All just rip-offs of the Tinyverse anyway. So they're welcome. Those.
Yeah. Actually, when I was creating that course, it was as I was just starting to learn Python. So I wrote all the content for the course using R first, so it was all dplyr, and then I had to translate it into pandas, and then some bits don't make sense, so the course had to change a bit because R and Python don't quite match up exactly in places.
So what was the profile of DataCamp, the DataCamp suite at the time? Like, what kind of courses was it? Was it more R focused?
Yeah, so DataCamp actually started up as a purely R training company. Mm-hmm. And it was only later that we got into Python. So I joined DataCamp back in 2016. And back then, Python was really only just getting started as a language for data science. And so I think we just released our first courses on Python in that year. And it's grown a lot since then. So I feel like one of the big changes over the last few years is that data science has really gone mainstream and data skills have become a lot more mainstream. So we've had a few iterations where we've had to change the curriculum and make them a lot more broad. So to begin with, like in 2016, it was only people who had data in their job title that actually wanted to learn about data. And that's changed now. At this point, everybody needs some kind of data skills.
And who would be, you know, from the DataCamp view of the world, who are the most, what are the job titles of the people who are the new, I guess, customers of you, but also members of this community of data people?
Sure. So, I mean, the standard job titles are what you'd imagine. So it's data analyst, data scientist, data engineer. But beyond that, there are a lot of roles where it's mostly a business role, but there's a bit of data in there. So you think things like financial analyst, marketing analyst, and then, for example, sales teams. Mm-hmm. In general, you don't need a lot of data skills to be an account executive, but you do need to understand the sales pipeline. So you just need that basic sort of number crunching ability. You need to understand like how to read a plot. You need to know maybe a little bit about probabilities, like, is this deal going to close or not? Am I going to hit my targets and make my bonus or not? So just having that basic level of data literacy is incredibly important for just a wide range of roles.
And any sort of wildly surprising new job profiles that when you looked at them across, you thought, wow, that's really interesting or unusual?
Yeah, so one thing that's really interesting, one of our customers is CBRE, so it's a big real estate company. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of people who are just basically selling properties or rental properties. And so the real estate agents are not really, in general, data savvy. Like, no one does a STEM degree and then says, okay, yeah, I'm going to be a real estate agent. And so they've got this huge training program just to give basic data skills to their real estate agents. And that was something that I never really thought of as being like a data career. It's just like you need a little bit of data skills in order to survive in the modern world.
And so it's more about understanding the fundamentals rather than like intensely technical training.
Absolutely. And I think that's been the major shift over the last few years, is there are a lot of people now who need a little bit of data skills. But maybe the number of people who need very intensive training, that's grown a bit, but not as much as the people who just need the basics.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to ask about that shift, because you said that initially people who already had data in their job title were taking courses. So what kind of courses were people taking in 2016, the data people, versus the kind of like more broadly applicable courses that other non-data people, let's say, are taking now?
So in 2016, the big hype was that machine learning was going to do everything. So there was a huge rush.
I remember that.
On like, everyone needs to know scikit-learn. And that was the hottest topic. You put machine learning in any kind of title of anything, and suddenly it became wildly popular. It's very equivalent to...
Yeah, funny thing is what you're saying.
What does that remind us of? Yeah.
Can we go back there? Oh, we are. Yeah.
Okay, so in 2016, it was more like existing data people wanting to learn this new cool thing called machine learning. And then over the years, it shifted to actually everybody needs data skills.
Absolutely. And I think the intermediate step was SQL suddenly became popular again. Because I think if you go back a decade, everyone was like, well, you know, SQL's this old language. If I want to do anything with data, I'm going to use R or Python, and SQL is the thing that you generate from R or Python. I mean, still, actually, if I want to write some SQL, I really like writing the language myself. Like, I spent a long time being like, okay, well, I'll use dplyr, this is the R package, to generate SQL for me rather than writing it myself. And suddenly it's become popular again. Like, everyone needs some kind of, you know, your data is always in a database. You need some kind of SQL skills. And now you would get AI to help you write the SQL rather than writing the R code to generate it for you.
It's just funny. The requirement for having SQL hasn't changed. We're trying to offload it to AI, but we can't offload the actual technology because it runs the world.
Even though increasingly none of the data underneath is stored or even computed in a remotely SQL way, but since 1992 at least, it seems to be the one universal way for describing a table, at least.
Definitely. And we're actually coming up to 50 years of SQL. So the first paper on SQL from Don Chamberlain and Ray Boyce, that came out in May 1974.
Must remember to host a party for that. So what are data professionals learning now? Like, is it still the same? You know, so I see there's a shift of broadening the horizons for other people who are not necessarily data people wanting to learn just how to work with data on a sort of conceptual level. But, you know, there will still be a bunch of data practitioners who want to learn things. I mean, what are they learning as opposed to what they were learning in 2016? Has that shifted in any way?
Yeah, so the main shift is that Python is eating everything. So back when I started at DataCamp, our R courses were more popular than Python. Now it's about, Python courses get about three times as many learners as R courses. But there's a big difference between individuals and people working at companies. Mm-hmm. So for now, if you're an individual, nobody starts learning R from scratch. It's like everyone wants to learn Python because there are more jobs available which require Python skills. But in businesses, there's a longer life cycle for programming languages because if you've already got a team, they're working in R, you're not going to change that. So it's a little bit more balanced in the business world between the two programming languages. But for individuals, it's almost everything is Python and SQL now. In terms of the skills that people are learning, it feels like the data scientist role has stabilized a lot in the last few years. So a lot of the skills are pretty similar to what they were a few years ago. So you need your data manipulation skills, and that's your pandas and numpy. You need data visualization skills, and then you're using Plotly or Seaborn. And you need your machine learning skills, which it's still scikit-learn and maybe PyCaret. Some of the changes are that there's been a lot more focus on being able to put models in production. So that means that you need some kind of level of MLOps skills. The tool set for that is still a little bit fuzzy. Like, there are just lots and lots of tools compared to data science, where it's like, okay, well, it's got two programming languages and a Jupyter notebook, and that's kind of it. So that's still a bit in shift. The other thing is that data warehousing tools are becoming more essential. So that means learning either Snowflake or Databricks.
Learning the what of those. Aren't they just SQL engines?
Yeah, so a lot of
it's
just about...
A couple of hit squads were just activated, and there's a number of drones converging on my
We'll get our first
I've already been in trouble with Snowflake marketing for calling them a data warehouse. They prefer the term data cloud. I think Databricks, they call themselves the data intelligence platform. So if we're being good on our marketing,
cloud
that's the term to use. Yeah, cloud data platforms. And so there's a little bit more to it. So you need to understand a bit about how do I locate the data that's there, and just learning a little bit more about governance and access, like how do I actually get access to the data in my organization is a big problem, especially if you're at a large organization where this has to be quite strictly controlled.
Has there been any signal you've seen from the market around cost optimization of these technologies?
So in the last year, basically, every company's just been, how do we save money on software? And so actually, this is one of the big pushes for AI. I mean, everyone gets hyped about generative AI because the idea is you can probably save some money by either making your existing staff more productive or by maybe reducing the number of staff on any particular task.
Good luck. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. But what about, I mean, in terms of executing things, right? So that's the interesting thing about SQL coming back every always. But then the underlying technology is constantly changing, and, you know, just take those two. Snowflake, Databricks have a quite different approach to both the charging model and the execution model underneath. And so I'm just wondering, is, you know, saving money on software, is anyone trying to teach or wanting their data practitioners to learn more efficient ways of processing data?
Oh, man. So I think the main request from a training point of view mm-hmm. is getting people to understand how to automate things. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Rolls-Royce came to DataCamp because they had a big problem with a lot of manual data handling processes. And mm-hmm. It turns out there's a lot of stuff going on in spreadsheets and things like that. And so just providing Python training to all their technical team meant that they could then automate all this manual data handling. And they just got 100 times productivity boost from this, which is quite incredible. There's not many areas of business where you can get 100 times benefit. But automation seems to be the main area where, at least from a training point of view, people worry about cost saving. Mm-hmm. I think IT departments maybe take a different angle mm-hmm. because they're worrying about licenses, and they really are thinking about, like, how do we run things cheaper? But it's a different part of the business.
Mm. Gotcha. And speaking of things that people keep reinventing, have you, it's very interesting what you said. This requirements for a data scientist have stabilized. I think that's probably good to hear. I don't know if the job's being advertised, but actually, no. I would say that the way those jobs are advertised and the way the jobs actually work in reality are maybe a little bit more consistent than they were 5-10 years ago. A few years back, a new job was invented called analytics engineer, which was, to me at least, BI developer with some of the letters changed. But that sprung out of companies that were web-first digital companies creating data in a NoSQL way and then saying, gee, how can we structure this data consistently and organize it around business entities and make it queryable with, gee, is there a common language that people use? Oh, it's SQL. What's your view on that and the convergence of the modern data stack / analytics engineer with what a lot of your customers have been doing for 50 years?
Yeah, I kind of think of it as being more like a sort of entry-level data engineer, because it seems like a lot of that job is around taking nasty raw data and turning it into something that the business analysts can use. So it's part of that business analysis workflow, I guess, mm-hmm. but it's earlier in the cycle. And I find it interesting because so there's this long quoted statistic about 80% of any data scientist job is really just data cleaning. And yeah. Actually it's like, well, you're an analyst engineer, 100% of your job is data cleaning now. I don't know how fun that is. Like, I guess
it's what I've always wondered. Yeah, like, good for people if they can invent a new role that seems to be a lot like other roles. And maybe that's because it grew up in companies that weren't big enterprises, right? But yeah, every role where you do something with data, you have to prepare that data. Maybe you call it cleaning, maybe you call it modeling, maybe you call it engineering, but there's no escape from that. But it's an interesting point that, yeah, those people have committed to 100% of their job. So they must really like it.
Yeah, so maybe the satisfaction comes from like regular cleaning of real world things. So you get a sense of satisfaction that actually the output is something that is nice and is usable by people.
Yeah, it'll be like the automation part, right? Like having an airflow pipeline or something just ticking along and not getting any nasty Slack messages in the morning. That must be quite satisfying after a while once you've stabilized it. But that sort of leads me on to something that I picked up on. So you talked about how MLOps is becoming, you know, a bit more interesting, presumably for companies who have slightly more mature data teams. What is the sort of breakdown of like beginner level courses to the more intermediate and advanced ones that you offer? Because I always think if you look out into the landscape of data education providers, you know, everyone has a million solutions for beginners, like start your Python journey, start your R journey, start your whatever. But then teams, you know, encounter in the real world will encounter other problems like, oh, how do we actually do this in the real world? Or what happens after I've built my first machine learning model? Then what do I do? So what have you seen in terms of the offering that you have, but also the appetite of your clients for that kind of thing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so one of the reasons that there are a lot more beginner courses is because there are just a lot more beginners for any topic than experts. Hmm. So yeah, beginner courses always get 100 times as many starts as the more advanced courses. In terms of our MLOps,
that could be why 80% of data science projects, it's always 80, isn't it? Don't go to production. I mean, yeah. there is a determinism there. You're absolutely right.
Where we position our MLOps curriculum is that it comes towards the end of the learning cycle. So you're expected to learn how to do machine learning before you put your machine learning model in production. Basically people go through, they'll get comfortable using scikit-learn and then they'll worry about, well, okay, how do I do this in something that's public facing? Yeah, it's definitely targeted at a more advanced audience. I would say it's mostly targeted at people who already have a job. Mm. And because it's a relatively new area and it's changing fast, that's another reason why you don't see that much content there already, because it goes out of date quite quickly. So at DataCamp, we sort of tried to focus on some of the more well-known and hopefully longer-lasting technologies. So for example, a lot of it is just about how do you go from just having a one-off script to having some kind of pipeline that's repeatable? Because in business, a lot of times you don't just work on one project, you're working on a lot of similar projects. So maybe reporting is the obvious example where you run a report and then, you know, you're going to run a similar report the next week. But also just going from one project to the next, probably you're going to work on a similar kind of data set, so the model's going to be pretty similar. So just getting that sense of reproducibility is very important. And then things like tools for managing tests, so A-B tests are incredibly common. You need to be able to know, how do I run lots and lots of A-B tests? Because our web development team is going to be tweaking the website constantly. You need to run several tests in parallel and make sure that they're analyzed consistently.
Mm. And do the sort of the corporate clients who come to you or to DataCamp and say, you know, this is our requirement? I mean, is there an increase? Like, in my mind, there should be, given the way the market's been and given the way the job roles have evolved over time, there should be an increase in people going, we couldn't make this work. Like, there's a piece missing from how we're operating, such as, for as you said, you know, having repeatable pipelines, improving models over time. The whole MLOps thing, like, it is that actually happening, or is this just a sort of fantasy that I have that people should be caring about how to actually do things in the real world?
Yeah, so there's definitely a difference between the size of an organization and the industry and basically how old the company is as well. Mm. So you've got a lot of companies where, particularly if they're smaller, they don't have the resources to have some kind of big in-house machine learning team or development team that can handle this stuff. And so there it tends to be a little bit more, it's not as robust. They're sort of the big processes, like they're not having to do thousands and thousands of these A-B tests, they're just doing a few. And so they tend to be more beginner in terms of, or more novice in terms of the level of skills they need, and there a bit of training helps. For some of the larger organizations, they just have big data academies and they can do internal training. And there it's just a case of making sure that everyone has similar skills. So not every team is having to re-implement the wheel. And that's where having sort of common training helps, because everyone's taking the same courses, they're using the same packages because they learned the same things. And then you get that cross-team productivity works a lot better there.
Mm. Yeah, no, but that makes sense.
I think your original question was just like, is everyone getting better at putting things in production? Right? It's like, maybe it's kind of hard to tell. It's certainly because there's a lot more awareness around this now, I think.
But yeah, and no, I guess my question was like, are people turning to providers such as DataCamp to get better at that process? Or is everyone just in a silo trying to figure out their own thing and no one treats it as training in the same way that they do when they learn Python from scratch?
So the short answer is yes. This stuff is getting a lot more popular.
Okay.
One of the tricky aspects of this is that for putting things in production, you need those data skills, but you also need software development skills. Mm. And different people have very different needs, because if you're coming at it from a data background, it's like, well, you need to learn how to program better. If you're coming at it from a software development background, you need to understand probabilities and you need to understand like some of the data science stack. And so no one goes into this from scratch. They always got some like pre-existing knowledge, but it's different from every person.
Do you have to then put a different spin on it when you train those two communities towards that common skill set? Like, do you have to amp up the engineering side for the people like me and amp up the other side for people like David?
Yeah, well, the solution we came to at DataCamp is that our courses are pretty short. So most of our courses are 4 hours long, and there are some that are like 2 or 3 hours long. And then you build larger training programs from those shorter courses. So the training has to be modular.
So you have consistency across many small modules, which lets you then mix and match. Because I think, then you get a well-rounded team who have learned some of the same things. But yeah, some of the data scientists are going to be a little bit annoyed relearning probability for the 50th time. And intro to object-oriented programming will be snooze fest for the engineering types.
Exactly. So you give different courses to different people and hopefully they end up at sort of the same place.
Do you have any insight on how many and what are the characteristics of the data scientists who, less the companies they work for, but maybe personal characteristics that lead them down that engineering path? I've advised lots of team leaders in the past that there is no easy answer and you should probably ask them. If you've got 20 data scientists, probably some of them want to be more engineering before you go out and hire others.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea how you predict what people are going to want to do without asking them. Yeah, you're right. Like, some people, for data science, it's all about getting those business insights, and people love exploratory data analysis. And for others, I count myself in the latter group, where I really enjoyed the programming aspect of data science and just being able to build software. Really fun for me. I think it is very much a personal preference, and I'm not sure you can do much better than just having a survey or, you know,
a career conversation
stuff. Yeah.
Well, I think data science is a particularly challenging field, I think, in terms of training, because everybody has a different journey into it. And so, as you said, Sean, some people come from academia, they don't need to be taught how to do science, but they need to be taught how to write code. And then there's people who come from a coding background who don't have the science. And so trying to build a training program that works for everyone is always going to be sort of patchy in terms of how much value different modules are going to have for different people. I think that's definitely true. So all your conversations that you have on your podcast with you know, various data and AI people, what sort of trends have you maybe picked up on recently where you think some of what we've just all talked about is going to change? I mean, whether that's to do with generative AI or something else.
So just on that sort of last point about how different data scientists have different skills and wants, I interviewed Cassie Kozakoff a few months ago, and she was talking about how there's now two different kinds of data scientists. So the original model of the data scientist was someone who could do everything. And I think data science have really evolved after the fact that if you want to do a data project, you need a statistician, you need a data analyst, and then probably you need someone who can write code, so maybe a software engineer, and probably like a database expert as well. And you couldn't actually afford to hire four different people, so you need one person who could just do everything. And it was this sort of unicorn role where people had lots and lots of different skills. And those people do exist, but are rare. But as data science has become more popular, there just aren't enough people with vast amounts of skills in order to fill all these roles. So the more recent sort of iteration of being a data scientist has been a slightly more junior role, where it's like, okay, you can just write some Python to crunch some numbers, draw some plots, run some scikit-learn models, and then I guess more recently have a bit of software skills. So there's these two different job descriptions for data scientists, where one is like this really high-powered role where you know everything, one is more
interesting. Richie, if you'd interviewed us in 2017, we could have told you the same thing. But
that's
I'm glad that one of our most most respected, personally, like both of us are massive fans of everything Cassie has to say. So I'm glad that our observation based on very limited data has now been borne out by further observation. It was a hypothesis when we presented it back then, but we noticed where we were working, I was competing to hire people with people who were trying to hire the unicorn, and then, but it's not even what I needed. But then that's what my HR team was saying that I needed to hire, but it's like, I don't need that. Very interesting.
Yeah. And I expect probably there can be some career fights because two people with very different skill sets have got the same job title.
Oh my God. I can't imagine the enterprise job leveling, you know, particularly as economic pressure comes on and there's downsizing pressure on teams that maybe aren't getting their work to production. It's actually interesting. Who do you keep round? Who do you have to let go? And then when so many different people, especially the bigger the enterprise, right? Multiple different units, there will have been everything we've said about people think data science is lots of different things and they go into it different ways. Even if it's now stabilized, any enterprise, you know, big UK bank, whatever, has been doing it for 10 years. So they've probably got 20 different pathways to one job role, 5 different levels. No one's ever really been tested on any of those things. That's got to be hell.
Absolutely. And if you're looking at the same job title and someone's being paid twice what someone else is being paid, there's probably an easy decision. And you might be getting rid of the wrong person then.
Yeah. And then there's also someone somewhere working on VBA macros, also called a data scientist. And so then you're trying to compare across all of those
or
people.
Not, but creating that 1-to-100 uplift in business value that Richie was talking about, like with the Python thing. And we've all met data science teams with lots of people who, you know, for many reasons may have been struggling to demonstrate their value.
Okay, so that's one thing that's changing, right? Is this fragmentation of and sort of downgrading of one unicorn data scientist to maybe a team of people who actually have complementary skills. So this sort of rise in generative AI, what do you see from your conversations as being the effect of that on, you know, data science, but also like data science education and education providers like yourselves?
Sure. So we use generative AI in quite a lot of places in DataCamp. And so mostly it's about helping people to learn faster. So there's a few different areas we use it. First of all, there's an AI assistant, which is going to help you find the right course. Because one of the big problems is that data science is just such a broad field. There's so many things to learn. Like
actually,
I've been doing data science
LLMs,
for 20 years.
Right. Typing in some vague stuff about what you're looking for and that's...
And what you know.
And what you know, and then what you think you need to know. And just having different options, different versions of your future presented back to you. I do that all the time for example, you know, organizing an event. I know what I want the event to be about, but getting that zingy title is difficult. You get an LLM to give you 15 options. You see one, you're like, wow, I can't believe it. And doing that across navigating the career path is a serious value add. Kudos. That's cool. Keep going. Keep going.
Yeah, I'd say like, I've been doing data science for 20 years. I realize I know like less than 1% of data science is just more than you can learn in a lifetime. So having that guidance on where to go is incredibly important. Then within our courses, if you make a mistake with your code, you can have AI explain where you've gone wrong. So just getting that instant feedback of what you're not learning very well and an explanation of what you
don't understand. But an explanation, not a red underline, not an auto-correction.
Yeah. So actually, this turns out to be like one of the hardest parts of building this is that in a learning situation, the AI can give you the answer. It can solve the exercise for you really easily.
Yeah.
Persuading the AI not to give you that complete answer and just to give you a hint in the right direction, that turns out to be a lot harder.
It doesn't like negative instructions, does it? Like, there's a classic examples of like, give me a picture that doesn't have an elephant in it, and it's unable to not put an elephant in it. This is sort of
it's a puppy
similar
trained
problem
to generate, right? So
yeah.
Okay, so we've got what courses should I study, and then in the middle of a course when you're having trouble, and the challenge there is a bit more interesting because it's about optimal teaching, optimal knowledge transfer to make sure that the human continues learning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the third area is in terms of productivity. So we also have a hosted notebook product called DataCamp Workspace. Mm-hmm. And there's a conversational AI assistant. So you can just type what you want, mm-hmm. and it will generate code for you. Also, if you're writing your own code and you have a bug, just click a button, it'll explain where the errors come from. So explaining errors is just incredibly important. It always amazes me how bad error messages are in software. Mm. And Python, I find, because I'm slightly newer to Python, I still find it weird that you get like an entire infinite stack trace and you're like, well, I'm not quite sure where the problem was.
But sorry, the life hack there is just to scroll right down to the bottom and ignore
it. Yeah, but again, why do these R people like Richie? Why do they have to scroll so far?
Right, it's because the software people who use Python want the option to look at the entire stack trace down to zeros and ones, ideally.
Make it, how many of them are really interested in the assembly level? But I think, again, if you have an exotic issue with some device driver and you have that terrible moment when you put it in Google and you realize you're the only person, although only the second person on the internet to have ever had this particular problem and your sound is not whatever it is, that ability to abstract away from that problem and do that is interesting, especially for learners, right? Like, because if someone does your courses, everything's working fine on their laptop or in your hosted environment, they go to a corporate cloud data platform, they put a comma in the wrong place. I mean, it's a couple of years since I used it, but you put a comma in the wrong place, you still get a stack trace type thing. Until you realize it's almost always that the comma's in the wrong place, all these errors look the same. So I think there's a layer of productivity for data people that's yet to be built into the platforms themselves that could really enhance productivity and in-context learning.
Definitely. So I think a lot of the sort of more traditional tools, you do spend way too much time trying to find that missing comma. Actually, on your point about like if you're only the second person to have seen this error ever before, then probably actually generative AI is not going to help you. It's not been trained on what the solution is.
It will only help you
one forum post.
2,000 people have had a very slightly different one, and somehow existing search can't do it.
Yeah.
Good point. So three great examples there of AI applied to make your product more valuable for your customers. Do you stay awake at night at all from the people who say, AI will replace your customers in their jobs, AI will replace the need for your product, AI will just tell people how to learn how to do data analysis, or the AI doom scenario? A lot of people in education are really worried. Are you?
It's something we've worried a lot about in the last year, because we have our certification. So you can get a professional certification to be a data analyst, data scientist, or data engineer on DataCamp. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about certifications is that the questions have a fairly clear answer. If it's a good certification and they're written in a way that it is possible to solve them. And so that's exactly the kind of thing that AI is very good at solving. And so if you really want to cheat and use AI to solve everything, then the only way to prevent that really is the traditional university closed room exam where all technology is banned. In general, what we found is that people are doing this because they want to learn, they want to prove that they have these skills, so just cheating is degrading that experience. So most people are honest and they don't cheat. Mm. Which is quite reassuring. If AI can do anything, there's one of the consistent answers I've heard from all the experts I've spoken to, is it really AI? Well, is it going to be a horrible thing? It could destroy the world. If it gets powerful enough, fine, but it's really in the hands of humans as to whether we use AI for good or for bad.
I mean, do you already see any shift in what people want to learn given the rise of generative AI? Or is that not really? Is it more like people are just using it to enhance learning things people were wanting to learn 5 years ago?
I mean, there's a huge demand for training around generative AI. I know, for like any podcast I do or webinar I do, if GPT in the title, then you know it triples the audience size.
We'll do that.
Put in the episode title for this one. Thanks for that tip.
It's a must-have skill set now. And everyone's learning from scratch. So it's just, you want to get in there early. Everyone needs to know this now. I think even people who are slightly less technical, like if I'm honest, like a lot of the jobs where you're only doing a little bit of data work, traditionally, like you can get away with using a spreadsheet. Now it's spreadsheet plus ChatGPT, and that's going to get you a long way.
So what level of technical detail do people want? I mean, are we talking like just show people ChatGPT, give them some ideas about how to write a good prompt? Or are we actually talking about people want to know how these things work under the hood, and then there's a rise of data science courses of like build your own LLM kind of thing?
Okay, the number of people who are wanting to build their own LLM is vanishingly small, certainly compared to the number of people who just want to be able to use this tool to be more productive. Mm. And here, I think a lot of it is just about inspiration on what is possible and what's just a stupid thing to do.
Okay.
I think generative AI has been hyped as a thing that can do almost anything, but actually there's a relatively limited number of things that you want to be able to do. And the next stage past learning just ChatGPT is learning to work with it on an API level. So building AI into applications is incredibly important at the moment.
Okay.
So there's been a rise in the number of people who want to understand how to work with APIs, and working with the OpenAI API is perhaps the most popular, and then also on the vector database side, the Pinecone API.
And then just from the other side of the fence, I've started training product owners and product managers to think about the new tools they now have to solve problems in their products and create a better experience once you have all AI. But the reason that course exists is thanks to generative AI. And so part of that course is to deprogram them from thinking that all AI is generative AI without throwing out all of the great things generative AI can do. But I'm very happy to hear that, you know, that demand that I'm trying to build from product owners and product managers to ask tougher questions, basically, of their data teams, their engineers, about what might be possible, that you're on the other side training those people to use the APIs rather than build everything themselves, which I think is, you know, when Dave and I worked together, you really had to build everything yourself. Even if you wanted to do stuff that LLMs can now do like that, it was all build yourself. Some business problems, you know, intricate forecasting problems, etc., still need to build them yourselves. But a world where people are more ambitious about what their applications can do with data, and then where that is proven faster by using pre-built stuff, I think is going to benefit everyone. Except maybe not data scientists, but you know.
No, actually, I really like your point about getting muddled between AI in general and generative AI. You got to remember that logistic regression is really not going anywhere anytime soon. A lot of these more basic techniques are incredibly important still.
No, that's true. Okay, and then finally, Rich, I mean, where do you see the future now that generative AI has come in to disrupt things? What do you think sort of your job, but also like the whole experience of data science education will look like in the next few years?
Oh man, I have to say I'm a terrible futurist.
That's fine.
A lot of my colleagues were like hyping up GPT like years ago, and I played around with GPT-2 and I was like, this text is stupid. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I don't think I could have been more wrong. So the future of education. So The big tricky thing is making education more personalized. And so I think that's something that is coming, but it's going to be a while before we see good personalized solutions for education beyond. You can mix and match these courses and maybe we swap out some data sets to make them more interesting to you. But a true personalization is difficult, but it's on the way. Beyond that, I see the trend for more people who are only casually interested in data and AI increasing. I mean, certainly in the last year, we've had a lot of people who have just, they've become interested in AI because of ChatGPT. And it's been really nice because until now, when I try and explain my job to people, they turn off after about one sentence. And now they're like, oh, you work in AI. I understand that.
Okay, that's an unexpected benefit if we're all cooler at parties now.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how long it's going to last. I think as soon as the mainstream gets bored with this, AI is going to become invisible again. But for now, it's a popular thing. I'm happy to ride the hype.
Excellent. Well, that's a very positive note to end on. So, Richie, where can people find you online?
Absolutely. I am Richie Rocks, most places on the internet. It's also worth checking out the Data Framed podcast at datacamp.com/podcast.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for your time and being with us to have this conversation.
Excellent. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.